Welcome back to season 4 of the FASD Family Life Podcast. This is the only show about FASD hosted by an FASD specialist and a parent with 30 years lived experience. I'm Robbie Seal, your host and mom to 5 incredible kids, including 3 teens diagnosed with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. As an FASD specialist, it is my passion to help families thrive. To learn more about me and my work, check out my website, FASDFamilyLife.ca. I started this podcast to be the friend I wish I had when my kids were young and to bring hope to weary parents. I wanted to share what I've learned in working in residential treatment and raising my own children impacted by trauma and prenatal alcohol exposure. But I need your help to keep going and growing. Consider becoming a monthly sponsor. Your gift of $20 per month would enable me to keep sharing hope and teach the skills needed to reduce stress and improve the lives of people with FASD and the families who love them. There's a link in the show notes that says support the show. FASD is a significant global health issue that needs attention, which is why I decided to go on a world tour to highlight the issue of FASD around the world, as well as the tremendous work being done to re-educate society of the risks of consuming alcohol during pregnancy, to advocate for systemic changes that would recognize FASD as a permanent disability and provide support for individuals and their families impacted by prenatal alcohol exposure. This week, the world tour continues with a stop in New Zealand and a conversation with Professor Anita Gibbs about her research that examines the FASD caregiver experience and the impact on the social, emotional, physical, and spiritual health of the caregiver. Anita trained as a social worker in the UK and worked in criminal justice, notably probation. She completed her PhD at the University of Bristol, and after postdoctoral research at the University of Oxford, she moved to Otago, New Zealand in 1999. Anita has taught numerous social work, sociology, and criminology courses since, with a particular interest in teaching in the area of families. Her research studies have included electronic monitoring, mental health, adoption, transcultural parenting, defining social work research, making social work accessible to sociologists, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, and its impact on families. Anita is a registered social worker and facilitates a parent support group for families where FASD is an issue. Anita is also a parent of 2 boys with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, so she knows firsthand that the struggle is real and so is success. I'm so pleased to have Anita with me here today. We've been having a wonderful conversation, and now I'm going to turn it over to her to talk about her research and the themes that came forward in FASD caregiver experience.
Well, kia ora koutou, everyone. My name is Anita Gibbs, I'm coming to you from Otupoti, that's Dunedin in Aotearoa, New Zealand. And I, in terms of who I am, I'm originally from the UK, but have lived in New Zealand for 20 plus years. And I'm married and I have 3 children, 2 of whom are adopted, and 2 of whom live with a range of neuro disabilities, including FASD, ADHD, and 1 also has a co-diagnosis of autism. What I want to talk to you today, or share with you, from kind of a range of perspectives, because I work at the University of Otago. I'm a professor of social work and criminology. So I'm a qualified social worker, and have practiced this experience, but I'm obviously primarily a mum, and I love my kids. They're now 17, 19 and 21. And we adopted my boys when they were 2 and 3. And our daughters was born just prior to us adopting them. So at my role in Otago, I do research. I've done a massive research project last year, of which I'm just beginning to unpack and analyze some aspects of it. And one of the projects that was my main project was interviewing 52 caregivers, parents, grandparents, whole range of people, basically, who were caregiving and loving our children that we love with FASD. So I explored the impacts of parenting. Beautiful people that I interviewed, parenting a whole range of children, you know, from 0 to probably 52. about 40% of my participants were Māori. So in New Zealand, obviously we have a big percentage, 15%+ of the population are Māori anyway, but about 40% of the people I spoke to were Māori, or were actually looking after Māori children as well. So I was trying to find out, hey, what are the impacts? And I kind of know the impact because of my own experience. It's like, oh, are you kidding me? From a day where we start the day to a day where we end the day, and you go like, was that 3 years? Or alternatively, did we actually, how did we get through the day? You know, we survived another day. Whew, we survived another day. Or sometimes, hey, that was so peaceful. Wasn't that glorious? Wasn't that a wonderful day? All of that, you'll 100% relate to that. But the impacts, I mean, the first section of, if you like, my talk in some ways are kind of like a bit heavy. Full on. Of course, the impacts are all out there. We use a Māori model called Te Whare Tapu Whā model, and we talk about the impacts on the physical, the emotional, the social, the spiritual. Really important to look at the holistic dynamic. You have in Canada the sort of medicine wheel that thinks about the holistic aspect, if you like, of all parts of who we are. So being an impact, you know, I'm going to share some quotes with you from some of my parents. Right. Here's a couple. Dramatic, of course. Affects you physically, mentally, emotionally. We're always tired. And I think this has led to exhaustion, to burnout, because you never have any downtime. It's always in your face. You can feel trapped. Yeah. We know what that feels like, don't we? Somebody said, look, I cry every day because my circumstances are so challenging. Others, I was depressed. I had anxiety. The role of parenting is so overwhelming. It certainly is. And we're not going to pretend otherwise, are we? Doesn't mean we can't have joy, but hey, it's tough. Physical issues. Another quote. I'm in pain all the time. I've got neck pain, shoulder pain. It's just the stress. It's like concrete. My shoulders are like concrete, and I've got to go to the chiropractor and have a massage because so much of my physical aspects are the stress that I feel. So, hey, that's real. For some people, coping with violence is a big deal. And, you know, you're on the edge. They talk about being on the edge. You're not sure what sort of things are going to trigger him off. This is one quote. It could be an innocent remark about, oh, don't forget you've got a doctor's appointment, and boom. Again, I feel that many of you will understand that the daily reality of these young ones with their wonderful capacity to dysregulate at the drop of a hat over the smallest thing that you go, really, the broken pencil? But the other thing was really rather much bigger, but no, the broken pencil, boom, boom, 3 hours of mega tantrums for some of us, not everyone, of course, but that whole self-regulation aspect when you're trying to parent a kid is a big deal, isn't it? And then there's all these other stuff where children sometimes hurt themselves, they headbutt walls, they might bite, they cause chaos at school. Parents talked about, you know, a lot of problems that they had to pay back money from their children who stole from others, as well as, you know, being stolen from themselves. So that was a kind of very much a long-term impact for some people. There's all the parent blaming. People were talking about the systems and parent blaming. There's a great quote. Caregivers feel blamed, not just the child, but the caregivers. Poor parenting, you haven't brought your child up right. So you end up retreating into your shells in many cases because the social circles become a lot closed because people don't understand. And the stress of day-to-day living is really not apparent to those from the outside unless people know you well. And of course, you've got to be careful who you let into your life, because the people who you know well, sometimes they'll go like, oh, that's too much, and you shouldn't be putting up with that from your children. And others will go like, hey, I'm on the journey with you. I completely get it. And I'll help you explain that to all the people outside of your home who do not get it, especially some well-meaning but completely confused professionals. The social impacts, you sometimes, you know, feel isolated, don't you? You can't go out, you have to cancel family trips, or you don't go on family trips anymore. That was articulated by lots of my caregivers. Not going places, changing friends, you know, losing family members for some, who, you know, grandparents who just didn't understand the what was going on with the children, assumed that they were just being naughty and should grow up and sort themselves out by now, or actually couldn't bear seeing some of the distress to the parents and caregivers. So, people have to give up jobs or move. I've got one parent who said that they moved locations because they could get slightly better services and care. So that's reality. Yeah. Or assessments even. And then the sort of grief and loss, which I know you'll have talked about many times in these podcasts, and just the the rewiring of your expectations to have to change your outlook on life, because you're looking after these wonderful children with all of their needs and challenges. Yet at the same time, you're going like, okay, maybe, we can get this far. And if we get this far, I'll be more than happy. And you just revamp your brain, you reframe your brain, as friends of mine often say in Australia, you are constantly, if not daily, actually trying to do that. So in terms of the spirituality, I thought that was another aspect of people's dimensions. And for some people, their faith, in fact, quite a lot of the participants, I haven't analyzed exactly how many, but I think at least half of who I spoke to had deep spiritual beliefs or had significant spiritual practices, but then with the family challenges had sort of let them go. So here's a couple of quotes. Somebody said, well, look, I know for myself, I used to be quite spiritually in tune, but not anymore. I joined the church when I was 33. I stopped drinking and swearing, but now I'm swearing like a trooper again, which I find quite funny, because I can kind of relate to that I've got a solid Christian background of faith. And but you know, sometimes when I hear what comes out of my mouth, I go, oh, what would my mother say? That sounds atrocious. And that's the aspect of the teen phase of some of our children. It's every other word. But I did find a great piece of research recently that I shared with, I think it was No Fast D Group, that was all about the benefits of swearing, to be perfectly honest. I don't want to highlight it too much for your audience, Robbie, but there were some clear benefits of stress relief and humour and, you know, light, unoffensive verbal dodginess, shall we say. So there are aspects to some of these things that you go immediately, oh, I want to be perfect, but you can't be perfect. You've got to be real. A lot of people talked about the importance of using karakia, which in New Zealand is using, the Māori sort of prayers and thoughts and proverbs and focus. For them, that Māori, spirituality and going back to creation stories, really significant in terms of the grounding and actually importance in terms of bringing the family together and connecting people. That was helpful to them. It gave them strength. Mindfulness. People practice, obviously, mindfulness and meditation. One person said, yeah, my daughter's driven me to meditation practice, which I thought was kind of cool, because it's exhausting, as we know, and we need ways to keep sane. And whatever keeps you sane is what keeps you sane and keeps you stable and loving for your kids. Participants talked about services. You know, obviously incredibly difficult to get services at times. Here's a couple of quotes. When you get a diagnosis of FASD, there are still no services you can access as of right. Our kids have all of the needs, but none of the services. And then another one on organizations. The organizations, everybody's protecting their own patch. You know, this is our patch. You can't tell us what to do with our money. And that whole sort of competitive aspect of agencies thinking, you know, mostly about, well, how do we make our services work? Rather than and actually trying to fit the client to a service rather than fit the service to a client. I certainly know that profoundly in our life. We've had multi-agency involvement for many years on and off. And occasionally out of, say, 10 agencies, you might find two people that you go, those people I can work with. The rest are just for their agencies and are really not thinking about the needs of the child or the needs of the child in relation to their family, when the family is actually the strength around the child. But they're basically focusing constantly on the child to the detriment of their stability in the family. So there's lots of things. And somebody said, I think a certain agency following through with the respite that they promised you would help. Too many false promises. False promises of potential help and not turning up with the goods. Nothing fixed. I noticed this with my own son, that people say this will probably happen. And then he thinks, of course, being the beautiful concrete young person he is, it will happen. And then they say, maybe, maybe, maybe. And then it never happens. And then he goes, well, why should I believe these people? They're just, you know, F me around and, you know, pretend and say things and never carry through. Whereas if I say something, I'm do it pretty much. And of course he does it immediately, which isn't always the best thing. People talked about they wanted agencies to believe them. You know, here's a quote, treat us with dignity and respect. We know our child better than everyone. Be transparent, be open and honest with us, work with us, support us to support our child. Look at us and look at, sorry, the child through the neurobehavioral lens. Listen, educate yourself, put accommodations and supports in place. And that's the point. I mean, it's like, come on, believe this nitty gritty of chaos that we often live, but joy too. You know, come and see some of the happy times. I've often found with my youngest son that people are always looking at the negatives because we've had intersections with justice systems and they're looking at the negatives. And I'm saying, well, 80, 90% of the time, he's actually doing really well. Where's the praise? Where's the praise? You know, you've done that really well. How can we help you do more of what you've just done? And I don't see that in the justice system particularly. I mean, yeah, maybe in other systems, maybe in disability support, you might see more of that. But certainly, I haven't noticed that in the justice system, which primarily seems to be about punishment rather than understanding children living with FASD. So people asked, obviously, the need to be supportive for caregivers. They talk about the need for wraparound supports. The sort of nirvana of real help. Getting fast navigators, of course, would be helpful. Most parents and caregivers, and they're amazing people, they're superheroes, of course, we know that. We are in New Zealand, and I'm pretty sure you are over there too. And, you know, you look at what they're doing, you know, they're advocating, they're case managing, you know, they're trying to find which service is going to meet which brain domain impairment, whatever it is, or they're fighting for diagnosis and assessment and diagnosis. They're fighting for funding, core funding, which is often not available for children or young people, or even young adults living with fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. So it's a nightmare. And they're trying to teach the teachers, they're training up the social workers. It's endless. I always say we've got a work-ready workforce. We've got a workforce who are working and they're incredibly competent. So if you want to learn about FASD, you really should be getting to know caregivers because they are the experts and you spend time with them. And people who've spent time in our home, this is a key point, I think. When people come to their house and hang with us, they see what we're capable of and they see how we do it and they learn from that. And it's interesting how that process of education and advocacy plays out, but often professionals won't come through the door. You know, maybe a few support workers might occasionally, but we find certainly that people are, no, you come see me at the office. And I'm going like, nah, come see me at our office kind of thing. So the strength of parents, the advocacy of parents is, quote from one parent who was doing all of that, having to fight for services. I'm the painful squeaky wheel and any incidents they know, I'm onto them. And I say, such and such got lost today. They need help. And it's that constant belief in your child and actually trying to help the world understand your child as you do. It is so important to share that with others, but to gather this to work with you in an ally type of way, isn't it? And come alongside you. So, parents talked about things that had helped them. Some people said nothing. You know, those were people probably in a very low space and were really feeling isolated. Obviously, family and friends who get it, you know, again, the people who'd been there on the long journey and actually understood and had probably helped educate themselves. Some nice examples of, you know, siblings of caregivers who were, you know, aunties of the children, but they'd sort of tag team and same with, you know, partners in long-term relationships, the whole tag team, so that one could even just have a 2-hour break occasionally or even sometimes a weekend, those sort of things where everyone got respite, the child, the parents, the caregivers, the rest of the family, really important. Occasionally, obviously, some professionals who are onto it. I mean, and that sometimes might not even be the one you most expect. I mean, you might expect a social worker to get it and actually find that they don't get it. But then you come up with we had a kind of reformed ex-offender who was a mentor, and he was just like, he completely got it. And he was just like gloriously in tune with one of our lads and just kind of knew what to do with him. And it was just fantastic. So it was like, I don't care about, you know, people used to mistake him. He'd go round town with my son, just get a coffee or whatever. And people would be thinking, well, is that, you know, gang member kidnapped that young child, you know? And my son would go like, people keep treating such and such as different and odd and whatever. And I thought, yeah, such an interesting relationship that looked incredibly unusual, but they got on so well. And, you know, it was fantastic piece of good professional work. And I loved it. So we have our, you know, people have their faith, they have their hope, they have their online groups, their online connections, which are so important, especially as we've known in the last 2 years for all of us. Where would we be without our online support groups and our ability to connect and learn and grow our knowledge about fetal alcohol and so on? People talked about the need for using medications for the family and sometimes themselves. And people were sort of straight up, hey, I've got my, you know, antidepressants. Hey, whatever, what works, it'll help me get through. And it's helping me stay, even be able to cope with the chaos. And often people saw those as short term. Anyhow, people talked about, getting funding when they could for different services, whatever those services for activities for their children, and the respite and so on. For some people, they needed supported accommodation. So their child lived away for a while and then came and went. That's really hard to get. It usually tends to be all or nothing. And then it gets a bit, of a problem to try and manage the relationships. And reaching out to help others. In fact, silver lining, reaching out to help others. That was definitely a strong theme where caregivers were going, well, you know, I can't always sort my own whatever out, but I can reach out to another person in one of my support groups or a coffee morning or somebody I know who's struggling as a caregiver. And I can just say, again, I get it. And I've become a stronger, richer person because of being a parent or caregiver to someone living with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. So here's a few quotes on that kind of silver lining. People said, basically putting yourself in a position where you're going like, can I do something? Can I reach out? I hang in there, but I'm reaching out to offer, support. I'm reaching out to help the child as well, to grow their skills and ability. They've got their challenges, but maybe there's something I can offer to help them live a flourishing life. He's blessed me in more ways possible. It's enriched my life being a parent of someone living with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. And more importantly, if we can have an impact on just one person's life, you know, that's just amazing in terms of enriching our life and the life of that young person throughout their life. Somebody talked about, using their skills, obviously, as a caregiver parent to go and work in a similar field. So they became support workers or they became, they weren't caregivers, sort of for respite before, but they added more to their caregiver suite of skills. So they became respite caregivers for others, particularly children who were, on the wild side. People talked about becoming more compassionate because they've been through so much suffering, I guess, and so much challenge, but they were able to grow their tolerance skills in particular. If I look for quotes, yes, there's somebody who said, you learn tolerance, you're thinking, I wonder what his problem is. This is just generally. I mean, why is he doing that? You know, looking out around them and being tolerant to all of society in a new and fresh way, in a way that they wouldn't have understood 15 or 20 years earlier. So they're looking out and going like, he looks a bit ropey. He's swearing on this. He looks like he's about to, swear at that police officer. Could be a case of some neuro issue going on there. So that kind of like real empathy to the social situations around them. They felt that, being caregivers, they kind of got other people who struggled a lot more and just got difference, I guess, and otherness in particular. So yeah, people talked about getting involved in peer support, voluntary work, advocating, of course, like mad, joining their local FASD network, developing new friendships with this big wide world of the FASD family, which is something very special, isn't it? And even, Robbie, you and I connect in that sense, the big wider world of the family of fetal alcohol. And then a couple of sort of points as we finish or think about the end of sort of talking about my research in particular. People were talking about, the importance, obviously, of training and, the systems needing to change, I guess. Here's people's training needs to be improved. So here's a quote, especially schools, this person says, because, you know, professionals should be able to spot this, these sort of behaviors and know what's going on. And in schools, maybe we need more people who are not actively involved in the teaching side of things. You know, it's other people, perhaps, you know, the teacher aides, the teacher supporters, the managers, that you've got to actually increase resources in the classroom. Well, we know that, of course. And it should be not on the basis of education. It needs to be on the basis of, you know, disability needs. So whether you define those as, you know, brain injuries or other physical injuries, you need other people around and scaffolding these children in the education context. That was some one person's, you know, vision for the future. And then another talked about people just generally, anybody working with our children, they need to educate themselves on FASD. They need to raise their awareness of neurodiversity, how it affects a child on a daily basis. Yeah, not just like when you see them occasionally, once a month. They need to look at our children through a neurobehavioral lens, not a behavioral lens. They need to listen. They need to do their own personal growth. They need to look at how to support kids with FASD at school and home and so on. We need our children not to be in the youth justice system. They need to, the place, supports need to be in place years and years before we ever get to that. We should never get to that, so they don't end up getting into trouble because of the tertiary symptoms of FASD. And somebody here talks about, again, the same idea, really, how frustrating it is to see the ignorance, I guess, all around you. You know, when you're actually working really, really hard, you're quite attuned to your children, you've done your own research, you've, you know, you're working out what are the accommodations I need to make in the home, and, you know, how can we enable those working in external situations with our child to make accommodations. And we know that on a daily basis, sometimes working with systems are more frustrating than actually working with our children. So this quote, this person talks about, yep, learn about FASD, realize it's brain-based and it's not willful behavior. And then they can understand where the parents are coming from, what the parents are dealing with. They need to know that FASD is brain-based, you know. No amount of shouting at a kid in a wheelchair at the bottom of a ramp is going to get them up that ramp. You know, if the ramp is, you know, taken away, or the systemic ramps, you know, are taken away, what can we expect? You know, our children are going to struggle. A further bit of that quote, she talks about if families are struggling, you know, there's a good reason for that. Rather than telling them yet again to do another parenting program, roll eyes, you know, if they're asking for help, they need more support. Find out what's going on. Make sure they have respite. Make sure they have a, you know, babysitter every month so they can have a break or whatever it is. Make sure that these children who are incredibly special, you know, get special helps and supports. So, I guess really, you know, those are just a series of quotes from just an amazing group of people that I managed to talk to last year who were all living the hard yards, which is, you know, what we know as parents ourselves, that there are days where you can, you know, really go, well, I wish today was cancelled. And yes, other days where you go, where you go, oh, well, I'll have today. And could we have another one of those tomorrow? And you go, it's not going to happen, is it? So you want to bask in the peace and tranquility and restfulness of today, if it's one of those days, or even if it's just a few hours. And then you go, right, okay, we put a closure on that day, because as we've always often say, don't we, tomorrow is another day. And for our children, they don't, well, I certainly find we might, you know, they don't hold grudges. If there've been some bad days, they don't rehash it. And because of us, our neurotypical, you know, way of doing, we have a tendency as their caregivers to kind of accidentally hold grudges, even if we're trying not to, so that 3 days later, we might still remember the incident on Monday, whereas the child is like, excuse, I thought we sorted that, you know, I've moved on, I'm, you know, I'm in the moment of now. And you're, what are you complaining at me again about Monday? And you're going like, yes. And it doesn't work, does it? It just does not work.
I've tried that, giving my kids the stink eye and the cold shoulder. And all I did, I got more and more angry, and they had no idea why I was so irritated. It didn't work at all.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's my kind of perspective, I guess, on caregiving, just from the point of view of all these lovely people that I talked to last year. And obviously in my own life that mirrors a lot of what we've been through, and we're still going through it. I mean, the longer you're on the journey, the more knowledge you are able to gain, and I think you do become a much better person. And people shouldn't despise themselves, because people sometimes do get a bit low and go, I'm never going to get this right. But it's not about you getting it right. It's about you reaching out, being as empathic towards your different children as you possibly can be, continuing to believe, for their welfare. You are it for them. As we often say, you are their protector. It's really important that you reach out and do everything you can, but obviously get the supports that you need to be able to be the best parent and caregiver that you can be.
Yes, absolutely. And key to being the best parent and caregiver you can be is training. Mm-hmm. And that's what all of these parents were saying. You have to educate yourself on FASD, and you need everybody else to, and mm-hmm. you need training, and you need coaching, and then you need mm-hmm. to be able to do your grief and loss work. That's key. And then you need respite. Those are the four mm-hmm. pillars of success. And every single family needs that. And we can't do this alone. Just as you were saying, we need support. We need respite. We need coaching. We need teachers who understand, doctors who understand. And this is the challenge, isn't it? Sometimes as parents, part of the burden isn't even raising the kids. It's that we're always shouting out into the wind that FASD is real.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just, and we've had quite a few, kind of news items, quite a focus in certainly in March and April on, in our society, FASD, and I've done quite a few media commentaries, and, you still feel that in the background, there are a lot of cynical people. As far as I can see, it's obviously about the denial of the alcohol culture fundamentally, and a unwillingness to look at the dark side of our societies and how we're drinking, how we're not encouraging people to reduce that consumption or to think about if they're, planning pregnancies and so forth. And just an unwillingness to allow, or to even challenge the alcohol industry as a billion-dollar industry. That sort of sense of David and Goliath, that if you want to say alcohol's not good, you're going to be in real trouble. People will come for you. All the emphasis on, well, the vast majority of people, of course, are being safe and so on. Well, maybe, but at the end of the day, I don't know if that's the case. Yeah.
Are they? Yeah. I would say they're not, because, the same person who points your finger and says, well, the most people are okay, is the same person who 30 seconds ago had never heard of FASD before.
Yeah. 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 So that's a sort of big question about and challenging that legal use of, the legal drug that we call alcohol. And even though we've got obviously decades and decades of brain science telling us actually, even small amounts are going to cause damage to an unborn child and so on, we prefer to ignore it. And it's really hard. And we try to obviously make it a women's issue, which it's not, because it's a male, female, young person, old person. It's society's issue, government's issue, local level issue, whatever, everyone's issue. And and so the denial of FASD is obviously very strongly linked to that acceptance of alcohol culture and its supposed benefits. But at the same time, how do we continue to educate? I mean, every caregiver who has a child with FASD is able to, articulate what that looks like for them. And certainly, when I'm hanging out with other caregivers, that's what we're saying. How can we help our, grandma understand? How can we help the teacher understand? How do we help the police officer that turned up at the door who still doesn't know what we're talking about understand? We talk about 2 to 3 minutes, summarizing FASD. And in fact, you get our children to do that. I mean, I don't know if you have with yours, but certainly I've got my youngest has got some really good, 2-3 line summaries, so that if he's in an awkward situation, he is really able to explain his brain to others, and it's really cool that he can do that. So it's like we need our children to be able to do that too.
Of course, they're the ones who are walking in that body. They're the ones who are in that circumstance. We're not always there, and mm-hmm. so they're the ones who maybe has a teacher who's informed, perhaps. But what about the day they have a substitute teacher? And then that substitute teacher is looking at all the students, expecting that they are all equally capable. And of course, ours aren't. They have certain strengths, but they're not going to be, you know what I mean? Accommodations are required. And so our kids need to be able to advocate for themselves. And they're only kids for 20 years. After that, they're out and in the world, and they have to be able to advocate for themselves and know who to call and know to go, mom and dad are always on my side. I can always call them. But yeah, you know, I just heard it recently today. Like, I wonder if in your work talking with caregivers have come across those who are like, I haven't actually told my child that they have FASD.
That's a really good point.
What's your thought about that?
Well, I mean, it's a bit like, because we're adoptive parents, you know, it's a bit like I've still met a few people saying, well, I didn't tell my child they're adopted. And actually all the research points to being open. Even if you can't give them the information, for them to discover much later, such a big thing, particularly when they're going through the later teens of identity issues. Where am I from? Who am I from? Why am I like who I am? Certainly there've been some really, big examples of kids being like, well, why didn't you tell me? And that then actually, never wanting to have anything to do with their parents again. I mean, really quite sort of dramatic relationship breakdown. And I think, the research suggests it's about being open, and you can be open from a very young age with, FASD. Even if it's obviously as a birth parent, but, you know, let's just say, I mean, obviously I'm an adoptive parent, but, you know, we used to talk about, tummy mummy, you know, being unwell, and then, you know, she herself had been unwell, and then there were issues going on for her, which then eventually led to her, you know, taking stuff that eventually, you know, led to an injury for you, and then your brain being different and all of that. And we just worked through that year after year after year and extended and expanded it. And then certainly for my youngest, grew that knowledge. For my eldest, he's more of a, I can fit in. I don't really want to go there too much, but maybe, the ADHD will be fine. I can see I'm different and neurodiverse. I'll just go with that. My youngest is all out there. It's fine. I'm FASD. I'll be proud of that. And I'll be proud of who I am, because, it wasn't something I had control over. I mean, I guess it's the stigma fundamentally that really influences people's, desire to perhaps not share that information. And it's more that negative aspect of stigma that they're probably reeling away from causing harm to their child by not saying. But also for some parents, just let them be who they are. Maybe they won't ever notice they're not that different. I could have some sympathy with that to some extent, but it's about the child knowing who they are, where they've come from, what is their background. It's a bit like people who want to know about, have we got any genetic disorders in the family? Why wouldn't you, if you've got a history of coronary issues or certain types of cancer, why wouldn't you tell your child?
And as your child gets older in school, they will know that, well, why am I struggling? Like, why am I the only one? My young children, I only get 1 out of 10 on every spelling test.
Yeah.
You know, if they don't know they have a brain injury, then they just are an idiot.
Yes.
So these are the choices as a child, or I'm a weirdo. I can't fit in. And I know I'm using unkind language, but these are the thoughts a child will have. I'm weird. That's why I don't have friends. I'm unlikable. Yeah. That's why.
Yeah.
Or I'm really stupid. And that's why, rather than saying, hey, I have a disability. These are my amazing strengths, and I have a disability. So this is hard for me. And so we, in my family, I've tried really hard to just normalize brains. Every brain is different. And brain injury, you know, every brain is different, and taking medication, a lot of people take medications to help their brains and, you know, to come out that way. And we started with, you know, a brain injury from the prenatal alcohol exposure. And then we worked backwards. And the way I was, I don't know, my kids were, because also they're concrete thinkers. I really love this. They never villainized their birth mother. They said alcohol did this to me.
Correct.
Which is correct.
Beautiful. It's beautiful.
It's beautiful. Yeah. So, but I think, and in my work talking with adults who have FASD, down to the person, everyone said when they got their diagnosis, whether they were 16 or 50, they all said, that was freedom for me. That was like, it makes sense. My life makes sense. One girl, one young woman who got her diagnosis at 16, I said, what did that do for you? She said, my self-esteem went up 1,000% because now I wasn't stupid. My brain works differently.
Yeah. It's the piece of the puzzle, isn't it? It's fitting to who they are. And that's exactly the same with those who are looking for, you know, often their birth parents in relation to adoption. It's filling some gaps that they kind of know are there, but they didn't know what their gaps were, and they couldn't necessarily articulate that. So I think, yes, wherever possible, we need to help our children know how to live well and flourish with their difference. Absolutely.
Absolutely. And we can't do this alone, and neither can they. They're always going to need a network of support. And you're only going to be looking to build that network of support if you recognize you have a disability. If you think that you're neurotypical, don't have a disability, then you're going to be on the train of independence. Well, and none of us are truly independent, I think we're really setting up our kids to fail if we're not transparent and real with the struggles that they have.
Yeah.
I think it's really important. So thank you for sharing your research. And really what all of those participants said is, living with FASD as a parent, caregiver, loved one is really challenging and not without hope. And that's the important thing. Even if, God forbid, you have gone through some really dark times with your children, addiction or incarceration, that's also not the end of the story. There is still a hope that that may be a period of time, a snapshot of life, but that's not the entire life. We can continue to build a strong family and build a positive future going forward. And I also want to be really clear that addiction and incarceration are not a surety. That's not where our kids are going necessarily at all.
No. Oh, no. Only a very, very small proportion may head in that direction for short periods of time. Absolutely.
For short periods of time. What's key to family resilience? Let's talk about that, because this work was all about families. What's the key to resiliency?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, people who become caregivers, I guess, by choice, are already quite well skilled, quite well stable in their lives, and I think and have maybe good strong relationships and some networks around them. They don't always know what they're taking on, but hey, you learn that as you grow. Same with having a birth child anyway. But they help seek, when they need to. That's really important, even if obviously sometimes they don't get that help. But they can, thankfully, with the internet resources, actually still grow their knowledge. So they're growing their knowledge. They're growing their skills. They don't take things personally. I mean, obviously, there will be times when it is so personal, but they don't necessarily become overwhelmed with that. Because obviously, they try not to carry those, burdens on a daily basis. I think if they carry the burdens as if they're the only person that can make a difference or really understands, that's going to be overwhelming and they will be burnt out. So if they're able to either share those burdens or to actually have them lighter, so they're not overwhelming them, and rework those burdens, I think, sometimes into ways of growing and enhancing their skills. By reaching out to others, that seems to be really important. Most of the people I talked to were in some capacity, not just caregiving, were finding ways to reach out to others. Even though it seemed small to them, sometimes actually that was very significant because they were taking some of their more difficult aspects of their life, and they were able to get beyond that and not be so overwhelmed they couldn't reach out. Taking breaks is so important somehow, and that's hard if you're a solo parent. I would say in particular, taking breaks is very difficult. Maybe sometimes people need to come into the house and even give you a break while you're in the house to do a few activities so that you just have a little bit of peace and quiet.
Have you done that? I've done that as a mom. Like when my three were little, I would hire a respite worker to come in and just be with the kids, because three little squirrels is too much for one adult. So I would hire like a high school student or university student to come in and say, your job is to play with these two twins.
That's it. You're right. I think it does. Yes, occasionally, definitely. And just separating the two fighters. In my household, the boys are fighter, fight, 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 fight. And if anybody could do that, they were a champion. It didn't matter if it was an hour, if it was several hours, absolute chumps. Hey, you've done it, champ. Sorry. Thank you very much. You've made my day, actually, because I just had peace and it didn't matter if I was whatever I was doing. It was the fact that they weren't arguing for a few hours.
Well, in our house, I learned, and support groups. Like I think when we're first starting out, we usually are so alone. We really don't know how many people there are who are also raising kids with FASD. Mm-hmm. And we are desperate to find a friend, a mentor who has a few years experience on us, who might guide us and answer some questions. I know I certainly was. I could never find that mom, that dad. But sometimes in support groups, you'd have someone who had an experience and you would learn from that.
Yeah.
And one of my big wins I had from a support group was a dad who said that they use separate for success. And yes. I'm like, wait a minute, what's that? And I'm like, is that like divide and conquer? He goes, no, it's way better. Yeah. Because it was talking about keeping the kids in separate rooms from one another at those hot times in life, you know, when maybe you're making supper or it's homework time or first thing in the morning when it's all chaos. Do you remember those days, Anita?
Yeah. Woo! I mean, when I look back and I go, you know, I've just got the one living with us now. Whoa. Am I so lucky? You know, it's like
it's easy street now.
Yeah. It's so funny because they used to just pile into the bed screaming and fighting each other, and you'd all be going like, you know.
And you're like, please be asleep in an hour. Please be asleep.
No, absolutely. So resilience is an interesting term, isn't it? It's like, you know, that people talk about it keeping going in spite of the kind of storms, but it's also resilience. Michael Unger talks a lot about this, to access services, and you have the, if you like, the social and financial capacity to access services. Those who are struggling to make ends meet, you know, with those extra factors of adverse life circumstances, poverty, illness, family violence, being alone, all of those things, you know, those things will make it harder to be resilient, quite simply. Yes. And that's where people need, you know, services and supports even more so than those who, you know, perhaps have got a lot of those things in their informal networks actually set up.
You talked about in your report about wraparound services being important, having wraparound support. I think most of us don't know what that is because, you know, you get your diagnosis of FASD and they say, you know, these are all the strengths. And then here's the three pages of deficits and you're going to need wraparound support. And then nobody ever calls you. Yeah. And you're the mom, dad who doesn't, or grandma who has never worked in child welfare, what wraparound supports and where do I find them?
And in every locality or region, wherever you are in the world, you know, you're going to have to find out, you know, which is where, of course, you can find an online group or another parent in your locality. So what have you used? What have you tried? I mean, most of our coffee groups, whether they're online or in person, it's all about that. Is that doctor any good for this? Or is that, you know, social worker any good for that? How did you take them on? Oh, what do you mean you went and you sat there and refused to leave? Tell me more about that.
You brought your tail crying. Exactly. I love that. Like, okay, this is real mom talk. This is exactly it. When the moms, the dads, when we get together over coffee, and that's exactly what we do. Who's your support worker? Are they any good? And I'm always asking, who's your pediatrician? Do they understand FASD? What psychiatrist are you using? And we do that with each other. We're like, who are the right supports to access? How did you get the IEP you needed? How did you leverage at school? And we swap stories. We swap tactics with one another, but doing that, we all grow stronger. You'll never find a parent who's not willing to share. Cause we're like, oh yeah, here's some gold. I'll give it to you. Cause we want you to win. Parents want you to win.
Oh yeah. Always. They've always got your back. I mean, basically they've always got your back. I mean,
absolutely. And I have a mom group, like informal friends, my mom group who we get together. I think it's almost like every week now because we all have teenagers. So it's by Wednesday. Can we get together on Friday night? And my gosh, we need each other. And you know, we're going to swap stories and we're going to be laughing, supporting, brainstorming, crying, you know, everything. But we love each other and we love each other's kids. And that's what we need. That's what everybody needs. And that doesn't happen instantaneously. You have to find people who are in the same ilk as you.
It's finding your tribe, isn't it? Your
finding your tribe. Yeah. Natalie Vecchione talks about that too all the time of FASD Hope. Find your tribe. And you know, like when you and I get together, we are of the same tribe. We get this.
Correct.
And so it's so fun. Same with the Natalie, of course. Now in Canada, there's lots of different support groups. And of course, online there is. I've recently started an FASD Family Life Community support group. How about in New Zealand? What support groups could you mention?
Yeah, well, I mean, we've had sort of localized training. We're actually, I mean, FASDCAN, which is, you know, FASD Care Action Network, which is the sort of peak body to support families and caregivers and educate professionals. They are about to launch a 7-week program as a pilot. And I can't quite remember the name of it, but it's based on some of the work that I've done previously, but extending it and actually making it more culturally appropriate and attuned to the needs of, you know, people in Aotearoa. But I've done some stuff with your families linking with families in Australia. And I've did an initial caregiver group in Dunedin. And basically, yeah, it's a sort of peer education, but it's also support groups, both digitally, as well as face to face. So those, support groups will roll out at different times, subject to funding, of course. So one's always trying to, you know, apply for funding to support these initiatives, but they've been very successful in terms of participation and people actually saying, yep, you've really helped. And we formed some good relationships that we've carried on post the initial 7-week. So there's things like that actually happening. But even within different regions, there'll be monthly coffee groups in a range of the different regions in New Zealand where people, yeah, just meet together, or sometimes weekly, I guess. So the whilst there's no sort of national infrastructure, and we keep campaigning, obviously, for national infrastructure that gets properly funded, in the meantime, people just get on with it and do what they can with the people that they connect with. So I've, you know, the one we've had going, it's only sometimes says 2 or 3 people once a month. You know, it's been going for about 6-7 years. So it's amazing how people just are happy to keep connected and keep supporting, and seeing the young ones develop and grow. And some do really well and achieve amazing things at school and achieve amazing things in their hobbies, and it's so exciting to celebrate that success with other families and caregivers, and then seeing others that are going through the justice system, you know, having, you know, just deep empathy for those struggling with those experiences, but seeing them come out the other side and then maybe having some hope. So all of that journeying together with other caregivers who live with our special children, it's very important.
It's vital because we do need the professionals in our life if they understand. If they don't understand, proceed with caution, I always say.
Oh, yeah.
Proceed with caution. But you know, if you can get government support or you can get formal support around you, that's important. But these people come and go from your life. You know, you might have the best support worker, but you don't know that she's actually burned out and leaving the job. Yeah. And then the new one comes on and they don't know what they're doing. While that is part of your network, your key part of your network is actually other parents who are living the journey, because first of all, they're not going to judge. They're going to love you. They were where you are and they only want the best for you to bring you along, you know, and this is probably the least judgmental community in a lot of ways. Yeah. We understand that FASD it's an invisible brain-based disability. And we start to look at these behavioral symptoms as products of that disability and products of an environment that doesn't fit. That's the secondary, tertiary. Correct. And so then we could just speak that into each other and educate one another and bring it along. Yeah, like Anita, don't you want to gift everything you know to like the young parents who are just starting and like, quickly, let me school you up so you can avoid all these other pitfalls that I made.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I think there is an increase in that knowledge bank as well as that skill set now growing in New Zealand. When I look back, maybe even, you know, 5 or 10 years and think, well, when I first started seeking, you know, you couldn't find a like-minded person, but heck, you know, there's so many now. And, absolutely, that's, you know, we're wanting to, grow that knowledge through whatever networks are going to work. You know, social media is obviously a really good way of doing that. And I think there's, you know, great capacity to continue, but we do also want the government to support us when we're doing that as well, don't we?
We do. We want to raise the profile of FASD so that we actually do get government support and also policies that are more kind and in line with a disability lens for individuals who have FASD. Mm. Absolutely. Mm. Mm. All right. Anita, as we wrap this up, what's your one big takeaway for parents?
That's a good one. Just back yourself. Always back yourself. Back yourself, because you're the person that's, you know, looking after your children. And you've often, you know, the dark days and the good days, but, you know, you are the best that they can get, and believe that you are, and actually almost flaunt that you are.
What a fantastic episode. And I learned so much from Anita, and I know I could see myself in those research comments. I bet you did too. I want to thank her for spending that time with me and sharing about the experience of caregivers in New Zealand, as well as the important work that's being done to provide the networks of necessary support, including support groups. If you are looking to join a community of support, I encourage you to join the FASD Family Life Community. We meet together monthly, and together we will deepen our understanding of FASD and build a community of support with like-minded caregivers. If you'd like to subscribe to the FASD Family Life Community, there's a link in the show notes that will enable you to do that. Do you have a topic suggestion or a question? Write to me at fasdfamilylife@gmail.com. Thank you for spending your time with me. I know it's precious. And until next week, remember, the struggle is real and so is success. I'll speak with you soon.